It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. 2015 is a critical year for the people of Ukraine as that country weighs a future filled with reforms. As Sabrina Tavernise of the New York Times recently asked, can a group of young reformers fix a broken country? One of those young reformers is University of Pittsburgh economics professor and Ukraine native Tim Malovanov, who has recently returned from a trip to his home country where he has been working as an advisor. He joins us now in Studio A. Tim Malovanov, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you.
It's been nearly a year since a protest movement toppled Ukraine's government. That was last February. Since then, the country has lost control over a slice of eastern territory and finds itself at war with Russia. In the midst of all this, describe your efforts to help transform the country into an honest one, because government corruption certainly appears to be perhaps the biggest obstacle to stability here.
That's correct. Corruption continues to be perceived as a problem, as a fundamental problem for Ukraine, and an obstacle to move forward. But I would think that corruption is a symptom rather than the cause of the problems of Ukraine. A number of Ukrainian citizens who live around the world, were deeply touched by the events in Ukraine, especially in February. I would say many of us were psychologically traumatized watching, essentially in real time, people being killed and the events unfolding in Ukraine. And that's something which leaves a mark on you. And so many of us were trying to help in different ways. In the beginning, it was unorganized, a little bit like protest themselves in November. We were trying to maybe donate money, find the ways to offer or provide our support in all possible ways. But after a while, we realized that we have some expertise and we should be doing something more than just sending money or sending stuff, you know, just equipment to Ukraine. And so we started forming groups of people who think about the issues in Ukraine. But we realized very quickly that there is no demand by this. So we were threatening experts in Ukraine and maybe some even officials, maybe because they were worried that we are providing, you know, competitive force for them in terms of getting grants or influencing the government. And so we got disillusioned by the summer. So we almost gave up around July.
So you're saying some people saw you as a threat.
That's right.
To others that were working inside Ukraine for change.
That's right. It's so easy in Ukraine to become dysfunctional. Any new group often goes into this regime of arguing among themselves, you know, whose ego is bigger or who is going to get funding from a grant agency or who has more influence on the minister. And these things get in the way of moving forward. And we observe even that happening among the politicians. So there is a little bit of a conflict between the president and the prime minister. We observe some competition, and some of this is healthy and some of them it is unhealthy among political parties, among the ministers. And that's a little bit, you know, that slows down the progress quite a bit. So it almost kicked us out from the scene. But then in July, we attended strategic advisory group meetings organized by the Renaissance Foundation and the Open Society Foundation, where they brought about 300 people from all over the world who had different connections to Ukraine, trying to create some kind of, you know, national convention, thinking, you know, brainstorming about where how Ukraine can move forward. And it was very constructive. And during that meeting, we had a little get-together among a group of economists, and we decided to form a little group and move forward. And in the beginning, it was a blog, and we started writing about the systemic problems in Ukraine, and we have grown since then to quite a formidable group of people who start making impact on the agenda.
So these are Ukraine natives from all over the world that are contributing to this sort of think tank.
Yeah, so we have a group. It's not formalized. It's about maybe 12 people. We have an editorial board, whatever that might mean. We have an advisory board, which is mostly established economists and policymakers around the world. The advisory board are not Ukrainian citizens, but the group is run by the editorial board, which is the Ukrainian citizens predominantly, with one exception. The person is a resident. He's a Belgian national, but he has been long enough in Ukraine for 15 years. And so our core activity is just writing articles. Around the blog foxukraine.org.
Vox Ukraine.
VoxUkraine.org, yes. But now we have been reaching out to media. We have started different projects, watchdog projects like a reform index project, Rada Challenge. Rada is the Ukrainian parliament, so we challenged the Ukrainian members of the parliament to report what they have done within the first session and such. So we're doing multiple projects. We talk to the ministries. We talk to the National Bank. Some of the members of the parliament solicit our advice on the issues or commentary. We talk to foreign think tanks and so on and so forth.
And so are the people who are in power in Ukraine, the prime minister, they have come around to being open to your ideas?
We are not directly in contact with the prime minister or the president, but we have been in contact with many people who bear on the policy advice close enough to the decision makers. We also have been talking directly to some of the ministers and also to some of the leading political parties. But this is all ad hoc. We essentially publish on topics which we find interesting or important, and that sometimes provokes a reaction from the policymakers. So I think we're trying very hard to transform the foreign or historical experience of reforms in other countries and make it digestible to the politicians and policymakers who are overwhelmed by everyday routine and don't really have enough capacity to understand the underlying deeper forces. So we're trying to frame it, not only just provide the analysis, but deliver the analysis. So we have grown into the group which separates the production of the content and delivery of this content and timing it. And I think it's very important because in Ukraine, in general, I think policymakers and the government officials, they would like to move forward. They need support. They lack capacity. Often there is incompetence or some kind of prejudices, and they're overwhelmed. They're really stressed, and therefore they don't have time to catch up on things they need to know. And there is this missing gap between what the standard policy advice from the West or from other countries would look like, and the ability of the Ukrainian policymakers to implement it effectively. Sometimes they just need help to help them understand what that means, really.
So you're giving them some practical advice, it sounds like.
Well, on specific issues, yes. You know, I can give an example of a treaty that has been discussed with Cyprus. Some of the funds were being money laundered to Cyprus historically in Ukraine, and that's a big deal in Ukraine because a lot of corruption or money laundering is happening through offshore companies. And there are attempts to reform these treaties to make it more difficult to launder money for corrupt companies. But just addressing that issue doesn't address the systemic problem of the reasons why the companies in Ukraine in the first place are looking for offshore banking. And that's because the property rights in Ukraine are not secure or maybe some other legal issues are present. And so we're trying to raise those issues as well. We're trying to talk about, in the first place, the reasons which force companies to go and use offshore banking and, of course, money laundering as well. And I think that's complementary to the direct efforts of the Ukrainian politicians.
And what are the reasons? Why would somebody do that in Ukraine? Would a company do that? I mean, we know why they do it here in the United States.
Well, of course, there is a reason of just tax evasion. Okay, that's one thing that's always there. But also there is a reason of protection of property rights. And if the property rights and institutions in Ukraine are weak, and the courts are and the judicial system are corrupt, and you can't protect your assets from political or other exploitation, basically you know your competitor could hire or could pay judges or attorney offices to prosecute you. So you will be forced to hide your assets outside of the country. In some sense, Ukraine tries to build surrogate institutions for those which are missing, and it outsources in one way or another a lot of institutions which are not present. And, you know, property rights protection is one way to outsource it by registering and keeping most of the assets truly outside of the country.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. We're talking with University of Pittsburgh economics professor and Ukraine native Tim Milovanov about this very important year for Ukraine as it looks to the future and tries to implement reforms. Dr. Milovanov, is there a new moral conscience in Ukraine?
Could you elaborate?
Is there a core group of people in Ukraine that wants to get away from the corruption, the old ways of doing business, and create something that is new, that is transparent, and that is more effective in terms of economics for Ukraine than what has existed in the past?
Okay, so you're asking basically if the new group of people in the parliament and in the government are going to conduct radical reforms, which drastically will change the course of events in Ukraine.
Right.
And
do they want to change from what has existed in the past?
I think some people do. I think there are about 5 new ministers out of 17 who would like a radical change. But now the question is if 5 out of 17 is enough. And the deputies of the ministers are guys who own payroll of different vested interests. And that makes very difficult for the ministers, even, you know, for the ministry leadership to move forward, because they can be sabotaged by people they don't even know who those deputies are working for. So that's one problem. And the other one in the parliament itself, there are maybe about 70 out of 450 deputies who are truly committed to the change, but not all of them. So the question is whether there is critical mass or not. And I'm afraid that it's uncertain.
So what are the main economic issues in terms of creating stability and some form of an economic base that can allow Ukraine to sustain itself?
Okay, so there are several systemic issues in Ukraine, and a lot of them are hidden in the budget. Ukraine has just passed the budget in the end of the year, and Ukraine faces serious foreign obligations, and there is a risk of default or restructuring or need to restructure. And if the IMF and Western donors are not going to provide financing, Ukraine might be in a very difficult situation, leading to maybe hyperinflation or technical default and basically deeper crisis than it's already there. The Western donors would like to see radical changes in the economic governance model of Ukraine, and that's not happening yet because there is serious resistance. I think, first of all, judicial is corrupt. That's a big deal. It's unclear how to clean up judicial. The second one, there are serious distortions with gas tariffs and the way some of the budget deficit is hidden indirectly. So, for instance, we have an agency in Ukraine, Naftogaz, which provides gas to consumers, and some of the consumers have very low tariffs, whereas manufacturing consumers have high tariffs, and that creates distortions, and there is a serious deficit. And then, the government is using the central bank to finance this deficit indirectly, and therefore the central bank is not independent. So the institutions are truly messed up, and they have to be cleaned up, and it's very difficult because a lot of people are interested, a lot of people benefit from this non-transparency and these confusing schemes, and these people are resisting to even technical changes. They're saying, you know, this cannot be done. It will take 3 months. It will take 5 months. And the outside pressure by the Western donors is essential, I think, unfortunately, is essential to force Ukraine to reform. So maybe the threat of default or the threat of the funding not forthcoming is actually the hope, is the silver lining for Ukraine. Maybe it will force the president and the prime minister to talk to the vested interest and say, guys, you know, we can't do anything. It's an issue of survival for the country and for you as well. So let's just give up and clean up a little bit.
Is now the best opportunity for change in Ukraine in terms of where the country is politically and now a year after the overthrow of the government?
I would think yes. Today is the best time, is sort of the truth moment, because the parliament is new, the government is new, the president is new. It's hard to see what prevents Ukraine from moving forward. And I think people understand that. The public wants changes. And if the changes will not be forthcoming, then the public and also the Western donors will get disillusioned, and that will be the end of this. So I don't think there is an opportunity to delay anymore, unfortunately. Or maybe it's a good thing for Ukraine. So the Ukrainian authorities have to move forward immediately.
I don't know if you saw this, but there was an item in the news over the weekend, former Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev warning that tensions between Russia and European powers over the Ukraine crisis could result in major conflict or even nuclear war. He said this in a German news magazine, and he said that a war of this kind would unavoidably lead to nuclear war. What do you think?
Well, you know, there are a lot of statements being made about, you know, the conflict, how big the conflict is between the West and Russia and such. And I think we need to understand what the objectives of Russia are, of the Russian government is, and how far they are willing to go to pursue those objectives. And then once we understand that, we can think about what is the optimal response, strategic response from the West should be. It's unclear what the objectives of Russia are, but I would say the tactical objective of Russia in Ukraine is to change the government and make the government more pro-Russian than it currently is. So the Russia will go far enough into it's pretty committed to this goal, if I get the goal correctly. That's my subjective opinion. Now, what can be done, and is this the interest of the West, to let Ukraine become pro-Russia? That's up to the West to decide. But if the West takes the perspective that Ukraine should go back and become pro-Russia, then there's no need to waste resources now. Okay. If, on the other hand, the West decides that for whatever the reasons, the West would like Ukraine to move forward and become more like a Western country, because maybe it's inevitable and it will happen. It's just a question. Maybe it's now or 10 years later, you know. Maybe it's just postponing the mess. So at some point, this mess needs to be cleaned up. If that's the position, then the question is how to make it more difficult for Russia to subvert the current government and prevent the regime change in the nearest future. And for that, there, of course, Western financing is important, and making sure that Ukraine moves forward and reforms itself, it becomes introduces clean institutions, extremely important. So the challenge for the West, assuming the objective of the West is to support Ukraine, the challenge for the West becomes in motivating and putting pressure on the government of Ukraine without threatening the change of government. The problem is that the government understands that they're strategically important, and the change of government is not in the interest of the West. So they have a lot of bargaining power, and then essentially they don't try to reform as much as they would have otherwise. So that's a very tricky balancing act for the West. And one needs to think carefully about and find ways to motivate specific politicians to move forward without really jeopardizing the stability of the new government, of this very same politicians.
We're talking with University of Pittsburgh economics professor Tim Malovinov, who is a Ukraine native. How did you end up in Pittsburgh? I'm sure a lot of people listening are curious.
I don't know. I was at the University of Pennsylvania, a visiting professor, and my visiting offer, you know, ran out, and so I applied. I wanted to stay in the area, and before that, I was in Penn State for 2 or 3 years. I was an assistant professor there, so somehow I liked the area very much. I like Pennsylvania.
Do you see your future here in Pittsburgh, or will you go back to Ukraine? What will happen? What do you think will happen?
Well, I enjoy being in academia. It just happens to be that I'm connected with Ukraine emotionally, and also my family is there. So I try to do it's my form of showing patriotism. Maybe this is a bit cheesy, but rather than donating money, I donate my time and donate money to the group. And that's a way to cope with the, honestly, selfishly, that's a way to cope with the psychological trauma I incurred last year when watching the events. Because my sisters live in Kyiv, and they live 5 blocks away from where the events took place. And my friends were on the square, and some of my friends were kidnapped. And, you know, I have friends who, you know, who died and things like that. So that's touching. But I would like, you know, I'm an academic, and I enjoy Pittsburgh. I like living here, and I hope it's my home.
And in the meantime, you'll be making, it sounds like, many trips back to Ukraine to try to help and do what you can.
That's correct. We have a very big group now. It's maybe about 20 people working full time. Maybe 70 or 80 authors writing on the issues, and managing the group is a bit difficult, so it takes time, and unfortunately I have to travel a lot because of that.
We've been talking with University of Pittsburgh economics professor Tim Malovinov, a Ukraine native and a member who contributes as a writer to the group Vox Ukraine.
That's correct.
Thank you so much for being with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Coming up, more Essential Pittsburgh. This is 90.5 WESA.